You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar.
And welcome, everyone, to another episode of Mythgreen's Podcast. I'm Oren. With me today is...
Chris.
And...
Wes.
And follow me on a journey through the improbable download link to the impossible podcast. Because today we are continuing our Hugo... Not really month, because it's six of them. Our Hugo 6 weeks. Talking about Middle Game by Seanan McGuire. For those of you who are not familiar with her... Seanan McGuire is a very prolific author. She has written a number of series, both under her own name and under the name Mira Grant. These include October Day, Encrypted, and Newsflesh, just to name a few of her series. And she's won several awards for her novella Every Heart a Doorway. That won a Nebula, a Locus, and a Hugo. If you get like all of the main like visual awards, it's called an EGOT. I don't know what you call this. And nuh is how I think you pronounce that, N-L-H. So she has a nulha. That's who Seanan McGuire is. She's also a filk artist, I found out, and I managed to find a couple of her songs on YouTube, and I really like them, and I want to buy them, but I cannot, because the store where she sold them from doesn't exist anymore, and they're not available for purchase anywhere that I can find. So, you know, I would like to buy them again at some point, especially the song Wicked Girls, which I've been listening to over and over again on YouTube, because it's great. But anyway, that's who the author is.
We discover Oren's secret filk passion.
Is it secret? Have I not told about my shameful filk obsession?
I don't think you have.
Oh, well, okay, now everyone knows. All right, Chris, do you want to try to explain the book? Because I explained the author.
Okay.
That sounds like an improbable task.
Okay, so Middle Game is about a brother and sister, Roger and Dodger, who were created by alchemists to embody this magical concept called the Doctrine. And just to start trying to clarify now, because this is an incredibly confusing thing, the idea of embodiment in this case meant like if you had a concept like death or order and chaos and you personified that right into a person, a character called death, which is something we commonly do with death. Apparently this story has embodiment of concepts, but this concept is called the Doctrine, which is not a normal concept that people talk about, but it's supposed to be a combined duality of math and literature, I guess? Math and words?
Well, maybe. No, actually, it's supposed to be everything, is what it's supposed to be.
But somehow you can split it into math and language. And that's the entire doctrine.
Apparently, math and language are everything. You split them in half. You split everything in half, and you get math and language. That's just how it works. I don't make the rules.
Wasn't it that, like, math and language just ended up being the successful one, and that they tried other, like... Are they opposites? That's what kind of like bothered me a bit. It's like, are you saying that like to complement, for two things to complement and form the doctrine, they need to be opposites, or do they need to be complements? Because some of the other ones that they like hint at when they have just their room full of babies at the beginning is like, I don't know, some kind of like vision future chaos kid.
We do meet another character who is order, who had a pair who was chaos. But it sounded like those were just a different embodiment of a different concept.
Yeah, so those were also supposed to be... Those were attempts to embody the doctrine by splitting it into order and chaos, and apparently those failed, because order and chaos was the wrong way to split everything, I guess.
Well, later it's explained as normal, everyday alchemists can embody lesser concepts, but nobody has yet embodied the doctrine. I wouldn't be surprised if that just changes throughout the book. and we just change what it's supposed to mean and what the explanation is, because this book does that. In any case, trying to get out of this rabbit hole of trying to figure out what the hell is going on. So Roger and Dodger are created by alchemists to embody a concept called the Doctrine. And these alchemists want to control them, but also want to give them a plot convenient amount of freedom. And there's lots of brother-sister drama. And despite all of the talk about alchemy, it actually takes place in modern day from a period, I'm guessing roughly 1986 to 2016. At somewhere around the end, they actually say 2016. And Roger and Dodger are, I think, almost 30 at that point. But yeah, so it's not actually steampunk or like retro. It's modern day, but like an urban fantasy with a masquerade, which took me a while to figure out that there was a masquerade. But that magic is alchemy, which isn't really alchemy. Oh man, I tried, okay? I failed, but I tried. Can I have my participation trophy now?
You can embody your participation trophy.
Oh.
I mean, I feel bad for A, whoever had to do the cover art for this book, because I have no idea what the cover art for this book should be. I know it shouldn't be what it is now, which is a Hand of Glory, because in the book, the Hand of Glory is like a tool that they use a couple of times. It's not really important to the story. It's just a convenient way of explaining how a character can murder someone without getting caught. And, like, stop them from being tracked, which first we had to establish that they could be tracked. So it's like a solution to a problem that the author created. It's just not very important, but I don't know what I would put in its place. The story talks a lot about the improbable road to the impossible city, which is somehow related to the Doctrine. So, like, maybe you could have, like, the siblings on some kind of road, but then I think that would look too similar to The Wizard of Oz.
And just so you know, the entire book is spent talking about the impossible city, but we don't actually see it.
No. Or really have any concept of what it is. And if it is also, if it is the Doctrine, or if the Doctrine lets you get there, or if it is unrelated to the Doctrine. I'm actually not sure.
One thing that is for sure is the first mention of impossible city, I was like, yes, awesome. And then I thought, can't you just put like most adjectives in front of city and it sounds like something cool to visit? Like underwater city, or I don't know, anything. Super city. I would go there.
The City of Lights? I mean, that sounds cool. That's just what Paris is called.
There's something about that word city that like you put whatever you want around it and it's like, okay, we got it. And clearly the author was like, how about impossible?
Yep, so impossible, it's never actually featured in the story.
Yeah, because that would be impossible.
Okay, so narrative style. This is third-person omniscient. Mostly focusing on Roger and Dodger, but then it also follows the villains. And then we also have, luckily short, excerpts from a fictional book in the setting that sounds like it should have been Wizard of Oz. Probably originally was before Maguire decided to make it a fictional book.
Similar to, but legally distinct from Wizard of Oz, which is weird because Wizard of Oz is public domain.
The fictional stories in the book are meant to be the writings of the alchemist who created the villain, James Reed. Asphodel Baker? Cool name. I wonder if in this world they're saying that, hey, somebody did write The Wizard of Oz, but it was Asphodel Baker who wrote The Wizard of Oz, and it's not called The Wizard of Oz, it's called this, and it's meant to corrupt people, or like, you know, spread her alchemy propaganda.
Did you get to the part where The Wizard of Oz is actually featured in the book too?
No, I didn't get that far.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
We learn that Frank Baum was a competing alchemist.
Ah, oh, boy. Okay.
Because alchemy also involves words somehow, so...
So we have alchemy, but by alchemy, what we actually mean, as far as I can tell, is the consensual reality concept from Mage the Ascension.
Oh, that would make so much more sense. That didn't occur to me.
That's actually what's going on. I don't know why they call it alchemy.
Well, come on, Oren, you know why.
Do I?
Yeah, probably because it just sounds cool.
I guess.
I mean, right? Like, I mean, ever since like Full Metal Alchemist, everybody's like, yeah, alchemy rules. This is like the most awesome of sciences and magics.
Alchemy does sound cool, but when you use it for something that is no way, shape, or form alchemy, I think it takes away more than it adds at that point. Should have found another like highly themed way to refer to this magic system.
Well, I mean, it kind of doesn't matter anyway, because that stuff's all in the background. That's part of what's weird about this story, is that there's all this confusing stuff about alchemy and consensual reality and the impossible city, but the actual story is almost entirely about Roger and Dodger just living their lives, and with the complication that they can sometimes communicate with each other telepathically, because they're, like, entangled or what have you, and that, like, causes some drama, is basically the actual story. And then suddenly at the very end, it's like, oh, oops, now it's alchemy time. So it almost doesn't matter what's going on in the background, because it's not really featured in the story at all.
And they communicate, like, telepathically, but they have to speak out loud, as if the other person were within proximity, right?
Yeah, do they? I forget.
Yes, they have to speak out loud to talk to each other. They can't transmit their thoughts somehow, which is strange. It suggests that maybe they could learn if they tried, but then they never tried, despite the need to be covert about it. Oh, we should talk about what people like.
Should we? Yeah, I suppose we should.
We're making an effort, okay? We're making an effort to try to praise books where praise is due. So, what's to like about this book? Why do people like it? Why did it get nominated?
I read some positive reviews on Goodreads and stuff like that. And we've talked about this word on Mythcreants a lot. And a lot of people praised it for its cinematic writing.
Cinematic? I just would never have considered that as a way to describe this book.
Well, I read it and then I matched it up and I was like, okay. Like, I thought that like McGuire's like writing, it's active. It's like, it's fairly concise. She moves it. But my bigger gripe is that she kind of does that on a sentence level, but not on a book level. Like, it's just so long.
Right. Her sentences might be concise, but she's actually very long-winded.
Yes.
It's, in fact, I didn't actually notice until I started speeding up the audiobook a little bit. So, because I need to get to the end. And I realized just how much time she spends narrating about things that overall just aren't that important. You know? And I can understand how, for some people, that would be very immersive, right? She gives you that feeling of living in this time period and all that's happened and lots of like little life details. And I think that's probably what people appreciate. Honestly, her narration stands out enough and is kind of like there all the time with how long-winded she is that I think to really like this book, you have to like her style.
Well, I can say one thing that I know people like about this book from looking at ye olde Twitter and people talking about it, is a lot of people identify with the character of Dodger as being autistic, which I can totally see. I think that's great. I agree with them. That's a cool depiction. It does get very dark, you know, for anyone who's listening to this and thinking about reading it, just, you know, content warning for self-harm. But a lot of people seem to have really found that a positive experience. So I can definitely see why they would like it for that reason. I also think that the main relationship being between siblings is kind of a novelty in its own right. It just feels like it doesn't happen that often.
Yeah, not without it being really weird. You know.
I mean, these two having like a fraught relationship because they have this link, that, you know, this telepathic link that they can't. But they live across the country from each other and they can't like admit to having it. That you know, that does create some interesting drama.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I did appreciate it as I was listening was it's clear that McGuire makes an ongoing effort to break gender stereotypes, both in choosing her main characters, but also all of the side characters. You could just see that consistently, like she was putting, you know, women in the like tough, brave roles and men in the softer roles, and just again, always making effort when she was choosing the gender of the characters to break those stereotypes. And that I found that very refreshing. But yeah, obviously, this book also just has some novelty, even though, you know, I'll go on to critique the theming. We've already critiqued the theming somewhat, but it still has novelty. And I can definitely see people, there's a lot of emotion poured into the central characters. I can see some people getting very attached to them and their relationship.
It has something that seems to serve Hugo nominees very well, which is that it is a story about stories. Hugo voters really like those. Like, in particular, Hugo voters like stories that claim to have something to say, and they especially like stories that are about stories.
Well, and if a story about a story features a main character whose power is language.
Oh, yeah, that too. You know, because a lot of Hugo voters are also writers, and it makes us feel powerful.
I have to say, overall, I was surprised at how much I feel like this is a similar book to 10,000 Doors of January.
It is very similar, yeah, I agree.
Despite the fact that the theming of the two books is very different, they have so much in common, both the commentary on stories, the interludes with a story within a story.
The word power stuff.
Yes, yes, the power where you can use words to create reality. They both feel like they need restructuring.
This one, though, and I think, you know, this is what it did better. And I don't know if it's because we got villain chapters, occasional ones and stuff, and Doors didn't. But this one just felt like there was more going on. I mean, there was more going on, let's be honest. But like the veil in this mattered more. And I got a better sense of possibility, even though we never see an impossible city or something. Like, clearly there's magic. Asphodel, who is basically Frankenstein, brings all these body parts back to life and apparently is the only one that can do that. And there's a doctrine. And whereas in 10,000 Doors, we had kind of like a heat vampire and portals and none of the other cool stuff that they kind of talked about that was through the other portals, you know?
The tension in this book is certainly a little higher than it is in Doors, just because Doors, aside from a couple of very minor sections, basically has no tension. Whereas this book, there's at least the threat that there are bad guys out there who want to do something, right? Whereas in Doors, the bad guy's main thing was, we want to close these portals, and that, I guess, might be bad in some very abstract capacity. Whereas here it's like, okay, so these murder people want ultimate power. Now, that's still not great, because I have no idea what they're going to do with this ultimate power. Like, why is them having ultimate power bad? What would they do with it? And the book never really got to that, or maybe it did towards the very end.
We get a lot of, they're really mean people, and so they shouldn't have power, which is all and well, but it really is much more effective if you have a specific thing that they will do that's bad. The tension is going to mean a lot more if you actually have specific consequences and not some abstract idea of they might do something bad because they're bad people. But both books definitely struggled with the conflict and tension aspect because they wanted a main character with slower lifestyle scenes and had really struggled to bring conflict in there, and both just have lots of contrived conflict.
Yeah, I cannot for the life of me figure out why this story is not about two kids at an alchemy school, or if you really want the separation, they could be two kids at different alchemy schools. Just have them be learning alchemy and then discover this weird connection they have, which we can establish a reason why they can't tell anybody. Maybe they find out after going to a class where they're told that any kind of connection you have with another person means there's a demon inside you or something like that. And then they, you know, they don't want to tell anybody if that's an important part of the story to keep. But that way, they could be at an alchemy school and, like, learn about how the alchemy works, and that would provide us with some extra novelty and also, like, an opportunity for some fun magic adventures while we build up the evil plan in the background.
Yeah, although that might require McGuire to actually understand and explain how alchemy works.
I mean, maybe. That would be helpful, but I don't actually think it would be a requirement. I have read a number of stories about kids going to magic school where the author clearly has no idea how the magic works. And that doesn't help, but it's still better than the alternative, which is nothing.
I have to say, just talking about the magic again and just the theming clash here, it was just extremely hard for me. Usually, if this was just explained as just being magic or being consensual reality, it would have been so much easier to believe all the stuff that they do in the story. I think there's a huge clash in that we're trying to use the trappings of science and alchemy. First of all, we have alchemy in a modern day setting, which is weird. And we have alchemy that's not actually alchemy. But then we're also trying to justify magic by saying it's scientific when that magic involves math and language. Things that are just not even slightly scientific feeling. And so I struggled with believability in this magic system, which normally a book just says, hey, it's magic and I'm fine. But with this book, I was just... the idea of the doctrine being like finite thing that would go in a couple people and only be there and then cease to exist everywhere else. It was a down point.
And part of the issue was that they established that, like, okay, alchemy is like part science, part magic. And I'm like, okay, I know what regular science looks like. So what is regular magic? Because right now, alchemy just looks like magic to me. I don't see how it's in any way scientific. So what would actual magic look like in this setting? Show me actual magic, and then show me how alchemy is a halfway point between science and magic. I don't think the book can do that, because I don't think there's any concept of what other magic would actually be.
That's too bad. It is strongly themed, but like the closer you try to look at that theme and how things work, the more confused you'll become.
Right, and it doesn't help that, again, this is all hidden. We only find out about little bits of this from the occasional villain interlude, which is just to remind us that there are, in fact, villains, because most of what they're doing has nothing to do with the main characters. And then suddenly at the end, like I would say in the last, I don't know, fourth or fifth of the book, suddenly now it's alchemy go time, and we have to get a ton of info dumps, because there was no time to explain any of this earlier. And it's all very complicated. And so this is why you end up with a whole lot of magic battle, is how almost all of the problems at the end of the book are solved.
Yeah, basically magic babble replaces turning points. So we don't actually get any satisfaction of seeing the characters solve problems because they just, oh, we have a tough problem. Magic babble, problem is solved. And that's it. Never feels like they earned their ending.
Right. My favorite example that I've talked about before is when they're trying to find, like, where is the magic location that has, like, the importance to fire and water elementally? And I'm like, okay, I guess we're in a four-element system now, sure. Then Dodger does some math magic babble and is like, the Sutro Baths! And then I was like, what? What are the Sutro Baths? Because they hadn't been established as existing in the book before. And the book does sort of explain them, but I was still really confused and had to go on Wikipedia to find out what they actually were, because I either missed part of the explanation or it just wasn't complete. And, you know, you just normally, if a place is going to be really important like that, you would find an excuse to establish it in the novel ahead of time. You know, just be a thing you would do. But, no, the Sutro Baths, they're a thing now, they're very important.
Yeah, the magic does feel like a deus ex machina at a number of different points, where it's so complicated and so arbitrary that when a character does magic, they will often do things that we haven't seen before, and then Maguire explains how that could be something that they can do when they're doing it. It's never established ahead, or it's confusing enough that you can't remember. So it's like suddenly Roger needs to like have random knowledge from the past. Oh, did you know that history is a part of language? And then he just, you know, knows that, right? And again, not established previously. And then it's also, at the same time as we are pulling out deus ex machinas last minute, it's also overpowered, so they conveniently ignore the powers they have. Roger has a command a person power that he frequently forgets to use, especially on the villains. If we just gave the villains some way of protecting themselves against this power, it wouldn't have really helped. But no, apparently he could have just commanded the villains to not attack them at any time.
He didn't believe in it, you see, I think is the explanation. One of my favorite parts is, speaking about how weirdly themed the book is the transformation of Baker. Because like at the beginning of the story, she seems really sinister and like she created Lee and like Lee is carrying out her plan.
Let's explain again who Baker is.
Oh, yeah. So Baker is a fictional author who wrote these fictional books called The Up and Under, which are quoted at the beginning of every chapter and really confused me at first because I thought they were what the story was actually about. And it took me a while to figure out, no, actually, that's not, those are just like stories within the story. These are the ones that are like similar to but legally distinct from Wizard of Oz with like a little bit of Alice in Wonderland thrown in. And they are heckin' sinister. And seems pretty obvious that whatever Baker was trying to do, it was evil. And then, towards the very end of the book, we change places, and now suddenly, actually, Baker was a good guy, and Reed, the bad guy who she created, has been running around trying to undo all of her work.
Early in the book, we established that Asphodel is the only person Reed has ever cared about, and he is trying to complete her vision. And the narration was very clear about that. And then later, we talk about how he was actually trying to destroy her work. And yeah, I think McGuire just loves Baker. And towards the end of the book was just like, I really don't want Baker to be evil. So that means Reed is actually going against Baker's wishes.
Yeah, that frustrates me. There was that great like interlude chapter where Reed goes to talk to the other like head alchemists. And as he's talking to, you know, like the old super alchemist guy who's in like robes while everybody else is in like normal clothes. Just like, I love that image of him just like walking out, like, kiss my ring. And Reed basically tells him like, I did it. You guys said I couldn't. And then Reed's having like memory flashbacks of like Asphodel begging this guy to like let her in. It generates a lot of sympathy for her as a villain, which is interesting because, you know, she's saying like these old guys don't accept lady alchemists apparently. And Reed's remembering that while he's just like talking to this guy and plotting like his takeover, feels like he's going to get justice for her. And then it just doesn't deliver on it apparently.
I am actually reasonably sure that that's what happened because McGuire is planning to publish the Up and Under books as actual books. And it would be kind of hard to do that if the premise was that the person who wrote these was evil.
I would go for that.
I mean, yeah, we'd read it.
A big part of me is wondering, because it sounds like she wrote these excerpts first for Middle Game, and now she's going to have to find a way to fit them into the Up and Under books that she actually writes. If we're just going to, like, if you read Up and Under, you'll get to a certain point where we have something that was established in Middle Game and it will just feel very out of place.
It'll be like those lines that are clearly written for the trailer, but they kept them in the movie or the TV show for some reason.
Yes, exactly.
Why did the character say that? Like, in character, there wasn't any reason for them to say that. It feels very out of place. Like, oh, it's because it's a trailer line. That's why.
I'm really curious as to whether the Up and Under books that she writes are going to have that effect with these little excerpts that were written for Middle Game.
You know, just to be clear, it is also possible that at some point there was an explanation about why it seemed like Reed was doing what Baker wanted and then changed his mind and is working against Baker. Like, that might have been in there somewhere. And Chris and I both missed it.
I don't think so.
Like, I can't swear it's not, but if so, it was so tiny and insignificant that it's essentially still a plot hole.
I think I would have noticed, honestly. I think I was paying attention to that aspect. I mean, I could be wrong, of course, but yeah.
Before we finish up, though, if you are considering jumping into this, we should let you know that this thing goes from zero to extreme grimdark at the top of a hat. I mean, the opening section, I think the first lines in the book are, there is so much blood. And then it's just kind of this like future forward scene before we flash way back. But then the introduction of James Reed's assistant Lee and how and when like she goes, for example, to go like kill a financier that they don't need anymore and just like does a bunch of like unnecessarily violent things to this guy. Like, it really comes kind of out of nowhere, I thought. And that the grim darkness of this just felt a little odd and frankly shocking.
I mean, it extends weirdly into places I would not expect it to. Like, there's a scene later in the book where Aaron, who is supposed to be like their ally and is supposed to be a good guy, has this long drawn out murder sequence where she kills another friend of theirs because like that friend found some information she wasn't supposed to. And she like tells the friend, you know, I don't want to do this. I have to for reasons. It's not my choice. And, you know, I'm sorry. I don't enjoy this. But the way it's written, I just don't believe her. Like, she draws it out and seems to be toying with this friend of theirs. And the explanation given for that is like, oh, well, she needs to know if the friend told anyone else about this. And it's like, all right, but like, you can't trust anything the friend says in these circumstances because she might just lie. And Aaron is such a badass that I'm pretty sure she could have found out some other way. So that whole scene is just really unpleasant. And afterwards, I'm like, maybe someone could just kill Aaron because she viciously murdered like one of the book's only people of color. It was very strange.
It randomly swings into grimdark territory. It never feels, in most cases, it doesn't feel like that was actually necessary in any way. But it feels like McGuire enjoys that and wants that there, is what it feels like, especially with that murder scene.
Yeah, definitely someone was enjoying that. I don't know who, but it was somebody, and I didn't love it. All right, well, with that note, I think that we will go ahead and round out this podcast as we have all embodied the podcast doctrine. And now we have unlimited power to do something, and that something is end the podcast episode. But before we do that, I want to thank a few of our patrons. First, we have Kathy Ferguson, who is a professor of political theory in Star Trek. Next, we have Amon Jobber. He is a Marvel connoisseur and urban fantasy writer. And finally, we have Danita Rambo. She lives at therambogeeks.com. We will talk to you all next week with the next Hugo book, Gideon the Ninth.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to slip us some gold press latinum, head on over to patreon.com/mythcreants. We appreciate it. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess.
This has been the Mythcreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.